A couple spends a turbulent evening dissecting every contour of their fraught relationship and spiraling into madness in the process. No, that's not a John Cassavetes film you're watching. It's Malcolm and Marie, a sleek Netflix feature starring John David Washington and Zendaya as a troubled pair on the brink. The intense film is the brainchild of Sam Levinson, creator of the HBO series Euphoria, and was one of the first major movies to be conceived, written, and shot during the pandemic. It's a very Tolkien, navel-gazy exercise in which two beautiful humans go on bitter rants about film critics and mac and cheese. I'm Aisha Harris, and today we're talking about Malcolm and Marie on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me is the co-host of NPR's Louder Than a Riot podcast, Sydney Madden. Hi, Sydney. It's great to have you here.
Hey, thank you for having me. I have a lot of mac and cheese takes.
I'm so excited to hear those because I have a lot of takes too. Also with us from her home studio is Audie Cornish. She's the host of All Things Considered and NPR's daily afternoon news podcast, Consider This. Welcome back, Audie.
Hey, everybody.
And joining us for the very first time from his home in Denver, Colorado, is writer and film critic Walter Chow. Walter, it's such a pleasure to have you here.
I'm so honored to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So Malcolm and Marie opens with the titular couple returning to their swanky digs following the premiere of Malcolm's latest feature film. Malcolm, played by John David Washington, is a cocky filmmaker anxious about how a white, unnamed LA Times critic will review his movie. His girlfriend Marie, played by Zendaya, is upset that Malcolm forgot to acknowledge her during his speech. But of course, there's more to it than that. Malcolm's movie is at least partly inspired by Marie's past struggles with and recovery from drug addiction. And his omission leads them to meticulously relitigate the dynamics of a relationship over the course of the night. Sam Levinson's movie came about last year after production of season 2 of HBO's Euphoria, which also stars Zendaya, was paused because of the COVID-19 lockdown. This project was seen as a way to keep the show's crew busy and employed during the pandemic, and it was shot last summer in an isolated, quote-unquote, environmentally conscious California house under strict COVID protocols. Unlike Euphoria, which has a sprawling ensemble cast and finds a way to drown seemingly every other scene in ominous neon lighting, Malcolm and Marie is a two-hander shot in splashy black and white. This film has been very polarizing among film critics and, you know, media who have seen it already on social media. Adi, where do you come down on this? Yay or nay?
Something in the middle. I mean, first of all, it is designed to bait critics most of the time. The lead voice and John David Washington, who is the proxy for the filmmaker, is complaining about critics. So in that way, it sort of tries to get ahead of things, obviously with mixed results. I think it delivers on the thing it's trying to kind of pay tribute to in the black and white photography and the couple argument, kind of giving me, you know, Mike Nichols vibes from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That's good. And you have two incredibly, incredibly talented performers who get the kind of showcase that they might have only, like in the past, this kind of role might have gone to Brad and Angelina, right? And then, of course, by me saying that, I'm playing into the thing the filmmaker hates, which is discussing issues of, like, you know, identity and politics when it comes to pop art. So I think it's it can be engaging. And for people who are going to be Zendaya completists, like I plan to be, this is great. Like, watch this. You need to see her in this. And as someone who is not a part of her Disney fandom, I am just very engaged by her as a performer. And if she was doing, you know, The Phone Book as a movie, I would watch that. And I'm not going to say this comes close, but there are certainly moments. and I'm eager to hear kind of how everyone else handled the parts of it that were just really wobbly, I think, that have to do more with writing than the performances.
I'm glad you mentioned Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because I also thought of that. It's kind of impossible not to, in part because, you know, that one really does take place over the course of an evening, and it's just two people who have been in a relationship for a while really just going at each other and tearing themselves out emotionally and sometimes physically. I don't know if it really quite succeeds in the way that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf does, but I'm sure we'll get into that more as we talk with the others. Walter, you are a film critic. This film has a lot to say about film critics. And so I'm curious as to what your thought is on the way in which it discusses criticism and filmmaking and all of that jazz. What do you think of Malcolm and Marie?
Well, I always think it's sad. I really like this filmmaker, Todd Solondz. You know, he did Happiness. He did really difficult films. And then he did a movie called Storytelling where he began to attack critics. And that was this first weak film. So I think whenever a filmmaker begins to sort of try to preemptively salt the earth for bad criticism, I think you end up in a really sad place. But, you know, I really despised this movie. I had a really hard time with it. And it wasn't because of the attack on film critics so much as I think you're always in a weird space as a white filmmaker when you begin to ventriloquize your grievances through minority characters that you've written. And he did this with Assassination Nation as well, with the LGBTQ community, with the young women and those ideas. And he had a lot to say as the child of Hollywood royalty, as a privileged, protected, sort of nepotized director, son of Barry Levinson. He had a lot to say about how he was the victim and how he resented the way that he's being seen. And so that comes out in Malcolm and Marie in a way that I think is really unseemly. You know, the film critic that they go after is the unnamed white lady from the LA Times. And all of the things that Levinson is so upset about, not being able to talk about African-American filmmakers, not being able to do the things that he wants to do and say the things that he wants to say and not be seen in a certain way. That's, for me, struck me as extraordinarily, not risky, but tone deaf. So in addition to it being sort of assaultive, this movie, it's like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but not good, you know? So in addition to being difficult on its face, it's also difficult in terms of, for me, you know, a young, white, privileged filmmaker ventriloquizing his grievances through this black couple. I think that's somewhere that he maybe should not have gone. And the movie seems to be like a defense of going there. And that's all it is.
Yeah, there's a lot of preemptive choices made here, not even just in that, but also in the music choices and the way there are moments, very meta moments, where they mention, oh, you're going to play this song now, because it just feels so spot on. And Sydney, I know that you actually have a lot to say about the music. What did you think about the film and how it incorporated music overall?
I mean, the layers of metaness, I don't know if that's a word, but are so palpable on this film. And even with the music, deploying that shuffle on the iPhone is it's never random. It's all so orchestrated from the moment they get home and Malcolm is just in his self-absorbed celebratory mood and he puts on some James Brown to when he actually realizes they're in a fight. Any woman walking into that house could have known you were in a fight in 0.2 seconds. The way she cut that butter, you were in a fight. But he was just so on cloud nine, he had no idea, which is usually happens between one partner and another. And then when he really does kind of acknowledge his wrongdoing, he puts on I Forgot to Be Your Lover by William Bell. There's moments where they have nothing to say to each other, so music is the buffer, and they do some, I think Zendaya puts on a Dionne Warwick classic, Get Rid of Him, and she's like talking to herself, get rid of him, oh no, get rid of him. Maybe like that. There's so many moments where the music does the work because the words aren't enough. And in a movie where there's a lot of words, basically all words, soliloquies, diatribes, all that, I think playing on the music was one of the moments where it was kind of a reset for listeners, for viewers, when they were just like, wow, I got hit over the head with kind of the same fight, different versions of the same fight over and over. Because at its core, it's a very triggering fight about being underappreciated, being self-centered, and being oblivious to the other person's needs. And so I think music has always given us the strength to communicate when words aren't enough. And I think that was a really strategic and fluid choice in this one.
Yeah, I have to say I had a lot of thoughts about this film, most of them not on the pro side. But I do think that the music for me was the one sort of saving grace. And I love that you mentioned the Dionne Warwick song, because I thought that was just a great moment of, I mean, yes, it was very obvious, but at the same time, I think that the body language and the shift in the tone and the move from one part of the fight to the next part in between that. I think it really worked in an interesting way. You know, I think with Sam Levinson, between Euphoria and also Assassination Nation, which Walter already mentioned, he has this sort of way of using satire and using things that you would see on social media, basically like hashtags, you know, all this lingo that younger people mostly have been using to talk about their traumas, their all the things that they are facing in terms of discrimination. And he filters them through a very stylized manner that feels stilted and doesn't feel real. And I think that even without all of the bells and whistles of the, you know, weird lighting that he likes to use and the sort of dreamlike sequences that he likes to employ, not having those here, it makes his dialogue seem even more stilted in ways that don't work for me. I want to play a clip that actually, this is one of the rants that goes on for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 minutes. And it's just a small snippet of it, but it'll really illustrate, you know, the way in which he's trying to talk about Blackness, art, and identity. And I think it'll get at sort of one of the issues that I have with the way that he employs all these things.
You can't hang everything on identity. You can't say that I brilliantly subverted this trope because I'm Black, but I fell into this one because I'm a man. Identities are constantly shifting. Does the male gaze exist if the filmmaker's gay and not straight? And to what degree? I mean, what if they're asexual? What if they're transitioning and you don't even know it? You can only look back at things and wonder what the it all means.
So, that's one of Malcolm's many, many rants about the white film critic.
Yes. King Kong ain't got nothing on him in that
exactly.
moment.
Exactly. He's out of breath, fighting himself.
Which is saying something about the directing. Mm-hmm. Not that this executes that well, but about the fact that he was not well served by this role. And I do think there's a reason there's a difference between the performance that Zendaya gives and the performance that he does, because she has more experience working with Levinson through Euphoria and doing whatever kind of collaborative work needs to be done to get the most out of that experience. I mean, I would definitely point people to the season 2 Euphoria special episodes, the one with Jules. That one was a collaboration with Hunter Schafer. And I think the ventriloquism that Walter has brought up, which I think is the worst case scenario for writer-director, right? For your people not to feel lived in, but for them to feel like puppets for your own ideas. I think that's avoided because those actors have more experience working with him and collaboratively. Whereas I feel like Washington maybe didn't quite have that. And as a result, he's just sort of like delivering these full throttle rants that are cringy, and I don't know if totally on purpose.
Yeah.
Like at first I was like, well, he's a bad guy character, so maybe it's supposed to be terrible. And then suddenly I was like, or this is just terrible. And there's no, yeah. People jump in here. I feel like
I totally feel
I was trying
you.
To be gentle because I could feel, I want to give these actors their due. It's 2021. I don't want to say these Black actors were puppets for this guy's ideas. They're smart, capable people, and they were involved in the making of what is a very small and intimate film. But like, yeah, not good.
But here's the thing, though. It's also, it's 2021, and I think we have, I'm not going to say we've overcome, but I will say that we have enough examples now of Black actors being able to be in their craft that, like, I don't feel as bad saying, like, that this doesn't
you
work.
Don't have rep sweats.
No, I don't.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that's fair. We don't have to hang everything on Malcolm and Marie, thankfully, which is good.
When movies are in such a encapsulated and intimate setting and you have nothing but these two characters playing off each other, part of the thrill that even keeps you watching is that you're supposed to ebb and flow with them. You're supposed to kind of oscillate between who you're rooting for. And that was one thing that I found so unsatisfactory in this film. It's like, it was so clear cut right from the beginning that Zendaya was like killing him, you know, like she was out acting him. And it probably is because of her pre-existing relationship with Sam Levinson. I didn't even consider that before. But going back to just the meta-ness, like the metaphor of using black and white when this fight that they're having is supposed to be filled with like nuance and gray area. And I was like, no, it's a black and white fight. He should have just said, thank you. Like it's, and coming away with it with that, okay, we did a full 360. We ended where we began and I'm fully more entrenched with her being right is because she delivered her point of view in a realer way, in a way that allowed me to suspend disbelief, like in ways that John David Washington didn't quite do. And it's really interesting that you brought up, Walter, the aspect of it being someone pulling his strings, like a puppeteer, like ventriloquist, because specifically when he was having that little moment with himself, that fight with himself, I was just like, who wrote this though? Like, is a white guy using him as his channel because he can't say it as a white guy? Like, what is the gripe? I'm sorry.
What is the gripe? Nails it so, so perfectly. There were so many times where I was like, what is this about again?
Right. Because, I mean, outside of it being so beautifully shot, like almost too beautiful to be real, that's also made me suspend my disbelief. But more in a positive way, this was where I feel like there was a hindrance to the overall performance and their overall like dance that they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, Sid, I think you nailed it so dead on there. I mean, it's like you do get kicked out of it enough to wonder who is saying this? Whose words are these? Whose grievance is this? What are you actually upset about? You know, to your observation about the music and everything, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it ends with an Outkast song, right? With a great Outkast song. But, you know, when you say, okay, now wait a minute, who's dropping these needles? Who's doing these drops here? When you're using James Brown and Outkast and William Bell and Dionne Warwick, when you're using those people in your film, who is doing this? What messages are you appropriating from someone else's art? There's an element there that I found to be uncomfortable as well. It isn't just sort of a graceless inability to express yourself, but also a desire to express yourself through someone else's art that I found to be troubling. Because now we're not talking about the John David Washington character anymore. We're not talking about Malcolm. Now we're looking at Barry Levinson's son, Sam Levinson, saying, mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to drop some Dionne Warwick here because I can't quite get the mood right.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I will say is that there was a missed opportunity. One thing the film was trying to preempt was the fact that Zendaya is much younger than John David Washington. She's around 23, 24. He is solidly in his early mid-30s. And we were wondering, is this another Jennifer Lawrence situation? Why is she playing a role that, you know, feels a little bit too old for her, especially since she's on Euphoria playing a teenager? And they mentioned at one point that she was, the character Marie was maybe 20 when she met him. And they don't mention, I don't think they mention his age, but it's like clear that there is an age gap there. And that there could have been an opportunity to really talk about what that means to be a young woman who is in a traumatic space when he meets her. And then he quote unquote rescues her. That's part of the other issue around the story. Mm-hmm. And like, what does that mean for her as a young woman to have spent some of her formative years in this relationship with this very self-absorbed person?
And then in the process of rescuing her, he siphons off her narrative.
Yeah.
For his own gain.
Exactly.
I think it'll be interesting to see what the path is for Zendaya, that how it diverges from a Jennifer Lawrence, especially if you've hitched your wagon to someone like Sam Levinson, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to say muse. I don't want to use that term, and I don't think she would either. But they are partnered in a way through these projects, and I actually wonder what that means for her in the path ahead.
Yeah. So clearly we have a lot to say, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on Malcolm and Marie. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And when we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Welcome to banking reimagined. Capital One checking and savings accounts have no fees or minimums and a top-rated banking app that lets you manage your money anytime, anywhere. Check on the account balance, deposit checks, pay bills, and transfer money on the go. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc is here for you with 24/7 access to board-certified doctors who can diagnose and treat non-emergency conditions like sinus infections, allergies, rashes, and more. And Teladoc's doctors can, where authorized, call in a prescription to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy? Sydney, let's start with you. What is making you happy?
What's making me happy this week, and probably the only thing that's truly made me smile ear to ear so far this year, is Chloe and Halle Bailey getting their own Instagrams.
Aww.
So for people who don't know, Chloe and Halle are an incredibly, incomparably talented duo. They came up under the wing of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, Beyonce. They're sisters. They're both beautiful. Crazy, crazy great arrangements, angelic timing and tone and everything like that. But they were always packaged together as soon as they came up, a la, let's say, like the Hansons or something like that. But now, as everyone is more increasingly online, they made the decision to finally make their own Instagrams, and they went on Instagram Live to Instagram Live each other from different parts of their house. And it was just so funny to see how these young women are not only coming into their own as artists, but as individual people, and they're asserting their different identities. Halle is primed to be in the live action version of Little Mermaid coming up, and Chloe Bailey, who's the older of the sisters, totally asserting her womanhood and her sexuality for the first time, participating in the Bus It Challenge. If you don't know what that is, check your hashtags right now. Also the Silhouette Challenge. And I just love that they're taking more ownership over what they put online, what they share about themselves and their respective identities, because it's only going to make them stronger and more relatable to fans and new listeners.
That is a great happy. I think they're, I don't want to say adorable because they're, you know, young women now, but
right. We would say they were adorable, like maybe even a year ago with their last album, Ungodly Hour. But now it's like, no, they're women.
Oh,
actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for that, Sid. Thank you. Audie, what about you?
What's making me happy is I was participating in the Sundance Film Festival and interviewing Questlove Thompson, who has directed a documentary, which is about the Harlem Cultural Festival, which came out in the summer of 1969. And this festival took place over several weekends. It's sort of like the people might tell you it's kind of like the alternative to Woodstock, but he creates a film that makes it much, much more. And it opens, just to give you a sense, with an incredible performance by Stevie Wonder. He's wearing this like chocolate velvet suit, this buttercup yellow ascot. He's dancing, he's singing, he's playing the drums. I think he's like 19 or 20. And what follows is just 2 hours of the most amazing footage I have ever seen of all kinds of artists, whether it's Nina Simone or The Fifth Dimension or David Ruffin, Mahalia Jackson. It's this nexus of Black cultural music and expression that kind of came to be in that particular year. And all of this footage was like in someone's basement for a bunch of years. And when they passed away, it kind of got passed on to these producers. So the film is called Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Be Televised. Hopefully it'll be coming around, you know, in this amazing world of streaming that we're all living in. Keep an eye out for it.
That is a great happy. I had the pleasure of catching that at Sundance as well. And I'm sure I'll have more to say about it when it does come out. So that is Summer of Soul, the Questlove documentary that just premiered at Sundance. Walter, what is making you happy this week?
Stuff like this is making me really happy this week. This seems like a cheap answer. I went through several because there's lots of good stuff happening right now. That documentary is amazing. Questlove is amazing. But I love the opportunity to jump on with brilliant artists and creators such as yourselves who have these things to say. I do this thing every week with the Denver Public Library where for an hour they have me talk about a movie from their collection. And it's been amazing bringing guests on, like Natasha Lyonne this week coming on to talk about The Seventh Seal. And then
Oh, wow.
We have Patton Oswalt in April talking about City of Fear. This is the worst thing that could possibly happen to us as a culture, I think, is the quarantine, the shutdown, right? But at least it happened at this time where we can string a bunch of tin cans together and talk to each other and maybe talk to each other and talk to people that we never would have before. So trying to look at the bright side of it. But that's what's making me happy this week is to have that fellowship with you.
Aw, cheers to that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you.
Fellowship. I love it. I love this energy, Walter.
Thank you for that, Walter. What's making me happy this week is a small little movie called Moonstruck. Which I just watched for the first time. I know, I'm like 30 plus years late. But so I watched Moonstruck recently, in part because, small little plug here, I am doing a seminar and live discussion about When Harry Met Sally for the Coolidge Corner Theater.
Small plug, casual.
Small plug. they've been doing this great series where they have different film critics and academics discuss classic movies, and then people can go on and register. And so I'm doing one on When Harry Met Sally, and I was like, I need to do some prep and watch some romantic comedies that I haven't watched before so I can kind of put this in context of the history. And Moonstruck was one of those movies that, like, I've seen the scenes and the clips, and I know Cher won the Oscar, and I know it's, like, one of those classic movies, but I just hadn't seen it. So I watched it. It is weird. I wasn't expecting it to be so weird. If in case you haven't seen it in a while, it's essentially Cher plays this Italian-American woman who, she's been married before, but, like, the guy died in, like, a freak accident or something, and she decides she has bad luck, and so she decides to become engaged to a man played by Danny Aiello, who you might recognize from as Sal from Do the Right Thing. But she doesn't love him, but she's like, well, you know, I had bad luck when I married someone I do love, so why don't I just go with this guy who I don't love, but who can provide me security. And then she meets Nick Cage, his brother, and things get really weird. They have a whirlwind relationship. There's some slapstick. There's, like, a lot of, like, older people falling in love or, like, being in love and expressing their love. And it's just a really delightful movie. And I realize, again, I am 30 years late to recommend this movie.
I am loving you delightfully delivering this review of this movie.
The discovery.
It's just so... You know, like Walter was saying, in quarantine, it's hard to find things to be happy about. And to watch this movie and to finally expose myself to it has just been such a pleasure. And I watch it with my partner, and we both were like, oh, this is really delightful. Like, it's really cute. So that is my happy. After 30 plus years, I'm recommending Moonstruck. I loved it. It's great. Finally, the pandemic has kept us home for close to a year, and maybe your viewing habits are stuck in a rut. And I just wanted to let you know that we are actually teaming up with a movie therapy podcast. If you're ready to switch things up and need some fresh recommendations, you should send us a voice memo with a question to pchh@npr.org. Again, if you need some fresh streaming recommendations, send us a voice memo with your question to pchh@npr.org. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Crafting My Style. Follow Sydney at Sid_Madden. Audie is at NPR Audie. And Walter at Mangiotto. That's MANGIOTTO. You can follow our editor, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And producer Candace Lim at The Candace Lim. You can follow producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. And Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you're bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all next week.
If you're into science, but you need a break from the coronavirus, NPR Shortwave has your back. Whether we're talking about how scientists measure Mount Everest or spiders that hang out underwater, we promise you'll have fun and learn something. Subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.